Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Employment Matters, brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host, Pete Waltz. Today's transformational leaders challenge the status quo, provide a vision of a promising future, and motivate and inspire their followers to join in the pursuit of a better world. But many of these leaders also fit the American Psychiatric Association classification for narcissistic personality disorder. They are grandiose, entitled, self-confident, risk-taking, manipulative, and sometimes hostile. In today's program, we're fortunate to have Dr. Jennifer Chapman, who will present why we often misperceive narcissists as transformational leaders and how we can avoid this bias. She'll also discuss what we know about how narcissistic leaders affect organizations, including creating unreasonable risk and cultures that are lower in integrity and collaboration, and how these negative consequences can be mitigated. Moderating our discussion today is Naomi Hazlett, partner at Miller Nash in Oregon. Let's join Naomi as she kicks off the program and moderates the discussion.
Good morning. Hello, everyone, and thank you for being with us today. We're looking forward to a great discussion with you all. We're excited to welcome Dr. Jennifer Chapman. She is the Paul J. Cortese Distinguished Professor of Management, the Associate Dean for Learning Strategies, and the Director of Berkeley Haas Culture Initiatives at the University of California, Berkeley Haas School of Business. Dr. Chapman is a world-renowned researcher, teacher, and consultant on leveraging organizational culture for firm performance and leading high-performance teams. Her research, teaching, and consulting work focuses on how organizations can leverage culture for strategic success and how diverse teams can optimize performance. Dr. Chapman's award-winning research has shown, for example, how emphasizing innovation in the context of a strong culture increases firms' financial success, how narcissistic leaders create organizational cultures that are lower in collaboration and integrity, and how norms to cooperate can cause members to blur differences among them, even if those differences are useful for group performance, suggesting that collaboration should be calibrated in diverse teams. Dr. Chapman has authored journal papers that include Transformational Leader or Narcissist, How Grandiose Narcissists Can Create and Destroy Organizations and Institutions for the California Management Review Journal, When Me Trumps We, Narcissistic Leaders and Cultures They Create, Academy of Management Discoveries, in the Academy of Management Discoveries Journal, and a recent article in the Harvard Business Review entitled, Don't Let the Pandemic Sink Your Company Culture. So with that, I will turn the program over to Jennifer Chapman, and we'll have questions throughout. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. What a pleasure to be here with you all. I've had a chance to take a look at some of the questions, which was terrific because it allowed me to structure our discussion around what seemed to be many of your interests today. So my goal is to cover three specific issues. One is to kind of lay the groundwork for what we talk about when we're talking about organizational culture. It's a very faddish topic, faddish meaning F-A-D-D-I-S-H. It's a fad. And so in that way, it's overused and underdefined. So I'd like to get us to have a precise definition of what we mean by culture and when culture serves an organization well. Second, we're going to talk a little bit about some very current research, hot off the press, if you will, on how culture change is occurring during the pandemic. Some really interesting observations there. And then we'll dive into the primary topic, which is how narcissistic leaders impact organizational culture and other perils. So let's start by talking a little bit about Culture 101. Let me start by saying this. After a career of research on organizational culture, I've concluded that there are three dimensions of culture that we need to pay attention to, or you can think about these as three criteria for using culture as a business tool in your organization. The first is that the culture is strategically relevant, meaning that behaviors that are prioritized in the organization are actually the ones that you need to be strategically effective. And in fact, culture is your strategy execution tool. And I'll give you an example of each of these. The second is the culture is strong, meaning that people believe what you're saying, that the organization stands for what it says it stands for and does what it says it's going to do. And that there's a high level of agreement and intensity around those cultural norms. I'll give you an example of that. And finally, what we know is that the most effective cultures are those that are adaptive over time. And that's why talking about the pandemic ends up being so valuable. So in terms of thinking about a strategically relevant culture, one of my very favorite examples and one that's used all over the place all the time, I'd be surprised if you hadn't heard this used as an example, is Southwest Airlines. For those of you in parts of the world other than the United States, you probably have still heard about Southwest Airlines. It's a low-cost, high-volume airline traveling primarily in the domestic U.S. Southwest has been around since the 1970s. When everyone talks about culture, they always talk about Southwest. And so one question is, why? What is the big deal about Southwest Airlines? Well, what's interesting about Southwest is if you think about that business strategy, low cost, high volume, when the company started in 1974, flying out of Love Field in Dallas, it was a very different time. Airline deregulation was in its heyday in the United States, and Southwest was only allowed to fly to the contiguous states of Texas. Eventually, they got the ability to fly all over the U.S., but they really were a disruptor in the low-cost, high-volume space of airline travel. In some ways, you can say they democratized airline travel, just in the way that, you know, Uber and all the travel services have democratized some of those industries. And essentially, what you saw is that Southwest had this low-cost, high-volume strategy, and they weren't really competing with the other airlines. They were competing with the Greyhound bus and your car. And in some ways, they said, we're competing with your living room couch. We want the flight prices to be so low that you're going to be motivated to get off your couch and go somewhere. So what's interesting about Southwest is they've been phenomenally successful. Everyone agrees about that. If you look at any financial accounting of Southwest, they've been profitable sort of quarter by quarter for decades at this point, the most successful financially among the U.S. carriers. And if you look at their strategy, it's very transparent. It's very clear what they're doing strategically. And so one question that we could ask is, gee, if Southwest is so successful and the strategy is so accessible, meaning that you fly once and you can figure out what they're doing, right? They don't have a hub and spoke approach. They fly 737s exclusively, which are the most fuel efficient, right? All of these things meant to bring down the cost of a ticket so they can increase the volume of flying customers, right? That seems so obvious. And so one question is, where's the competition? Why hasn't Southwest faced significant competition in the low-cost, high-volume space? And believe me, dozens of airlines have tried. And I would argue that one of the reasons that Southwest has been so phenomenally successful and competitors have had a hard time penetrating that strategy is because of Southwest's culture. And let me give you an example of exactly what I mean here, because this is really important to get culture down to the very basis. If you fly Southwest, one thing that you'll notice is that their turn times are lower than anyone else on the planet. They turn the planes in an average of 20 minutes versus the industry average of 45 minutes. If you turn the planes faster, you can fly more routes with fewer planes, right? That's a great way to lower costs, 20 minutes versus the industry average of 45 minutes. Well, we're talking about some pretty sophisticated players, United, Delta, American. Why can't they turn the planes in 20 minutes if Southwest can figure it out? I argue that it has to do with their culture. And essentially what happens on Southwest is everyone does whatever it takes in the moment to turn those planes in 20 minutes, whether it's flight attendants picking up garbage, whether it's pilots chunking up the ice, getting ready to serve the Diet Coke on the next flight, whether it's customer service agents putting the last bag into the belly of the plane. Everyone does whatever it takes to turn that plane in 20 minutes, and it's the only way it works. Well, what's also interesting is that 90% of Southwest employees are members of a labor union. Everybody understands that they are better off blurring those job descriptions so that they can get the planes off the ground in 20 minutes. That is a cultural advantage that Southwest has. The belief among employees, which is widespread and strongly held, that we all contribute to turn time is absolutely essential. And in this way, culture contributes to strategic advantage by enabling organizations to execute on their strategy more effectively than anyone else. So you notice I haven't defined culture yet, so let me do that now. Here's a kind of textbook example of how we would define culture. It's a pattern of beliefs and expectations that people share. These beliefs and expectations produce what we call behavioral norms. So I'm a social psychologist by training and have studied norms for my whole career, which now is very long. And norms can be defined as expectations about what's appropriate in a particular situation. These are not the same as rules. They're socially created standards that help us interpret and evaluate behavior. So even with my kind of academic interest in norms, I wasn't as impressed by the power of norms until I heard about an epidemiologic study that was done about 10 years ago, which ends up being very relevant today, that had sort of phenomenal findings that really show the power of norms. So some epidemiologists were interested in hand-washing behavior in public restrooms, right? Today, this is very important with the pandemic. Hand-washing behavior in public restrooms. What can we do to increase people's propensity to wash their hands out in public? So the researchers structured a controlled field experiment with two conditions. In the first condition, unsuspecting members of the public at large would walk into a public restroom. And in this case, there was another person there in the restroom. That person was a confederate of the experiment. They were in on it. And so we're just going to record the incidence of hand washing in that condition. Second condition, unsuspecting member of the public at large would walk into a public restroom. But this time, apparently, nobody else is there. But the researchers have installed a hidden video camera over the sink to record hand washing behavior. And so you're way ahead of me, I'm sure. The research question is, will we see a difference in the incidence of hand washing across these two settings? What do you think? I can hear you out there saying yes, right? So the answer is yes. And what they found was in the first condition, when the Confederate was there, 90% of people washed their hands, 90. You know, for me, that's a good number, okay? Great, right? Because like the 10% who don't do it in that condition, you kind of already know who those folks are. 90%, great. In the second condition, when people thought they were alone, 16% washed their hands. So now why would I tell you this? And, you know, Gary Larson of Farside fame must have been tracking this research, right? Why would I tell you this? Certainly, I tell you so that you can encourage others to wash their hands or stay in that restroom just a little longer so the next person washes their hands. But I'm telling you this as a social scientist because it gives us insight into what motivates behavior. We are so invested in accommodating the norms and rules in our social group that we are willing and likely to alter our behavior, that is to do something different in the presence of another person compared to what we would have done had we been alone. And the question is why? Why is that such a natural reflex for us to be norm adherent? And the answer is that the cost of violating shared social norms at best is going to be embarrassment, as we see the gentleman coming out of the bathroom that has the sign. At best, you're going to be embarrassed. At worst, if you violate a significant enough norm, you are going to be ejected or excluded from the group. And as social beings, that interdependence is so vital to our survival that we have developed a radar to try to understand what the norms are and to adhere to them as readily as possible. Well, that's exactly how culture works in organizations, is people have a radar up for the norms that exist in that context, and they are predisposed to adhere to those norms. So what it suggests is if the culture is wrong, in other words, if the norms are undermining behavior right? People are going to adhere to those norms and you're going to get more undermining behavior. And this is why it's so important for leaders and organizations to be clear about the strategically effective norms in their organization. A second criterion is that the culture needs to be strong. And actually, Naomi, I think we had a question about that.
We did. So one of the questions that we have is, are there ways to evaluate candidates that organizations can use to promote qualities that lead to this strong culture?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And there's a much longer answer that we can entertain, but let me give you a quick answer now that gives you a sense for what we're talking about here. So there are many strong culture organizations. Netflix is one of them. Netflix is a company that's now producing content and streaming all over the world. They're located here in California. And one of the things that we see at Netflix is a very precise hiring model. That hiring model insists that they hire, and these are exactly their words, no brilliant jerks. Some companies tolerate us. For us, the cost of teamwork is too high. Diverse styles are fine as long as the person embodies the values. This foreshadows our conversation about narcissism. This is a great way to preclude hiring narcissists, as we'll talk about in a little bit. They go on to say, we're a team, not a family. We're like a pro sports team. It's the coach's job at every level of Netflix to hire, develop, and cut smartly. So we have stars in every position. And then they impose what they call the keeper test, which is, which of my people, if they told me they were leaving for a similar job at a peer company, would I fight hard to keep at Netflix? The other people should get a generous severance now so we can open a slot to find a star for that role. At Netflix, adequate performance gets a generous severance package. And what's interesting about this model is if you look at Netflix from a financial standpoint, they are doing unbelievably well by any standard. They are a huge organization, $215 billion market cap at last check. And yet the number of employees in this organization, 8,000. If you look at a company like Disney, which has about half the market cap, Disney has over 120,000 people. So by this model, what you can see is that each hire is very leveraged within Netflix. So you need to be thoughtful about bringing in people who resonate with the culture they're trying to create in this organization. So when we talk about a strong culture, what we mean is there's both intensity about what's important and agreement about what's important. And many organizations are actually, so if you're high on both, you have the green quadrant, a strong culture. If you're low on both, you have what we call a weak culture. You can also be high on agreement and low on intensity, what we call vacuous beliefs. This is actually the most common when we quantitatively measure organizations on their strength. Vacuous beliefs comes up the most often. And this is what shows us that culture is faddish. People are willing to talk a big game about culture, but they're not really deliberate in laying it in a strategically relevant way. The other possibility is to have high intensity and low agreement, what we call warring factions. And in some organizations, for example, you know, marketing and engineering can't get together on things. I actually think warring factions is a better problem to have than vacuous beliefs, but both are challenges that are worth exploring. Okay. So our first lesson so far is that culture won't help you unless it's strategically relevant. Second, everyone has to uphold the culture. That's when it's strong. Even when it's hard to do so, even when it's not absolutely necessary, and even in the bathroom washing your hands when no one else is looking. And when you know that people are adhering to those norms, even in private, you know that they've internalized them as relevant and important in that context. So let me talk for just a brief moment about culture adaptability and thinking about this during the pandemic. We recently conducted a study where we were interested in how culture mattered on the bottom line for organizations in terms of financial success. And so for colleagues of yours who are skeptical about culture, this is a great study to share with them. What we did was we tracked 60 of the largest publicly traded high technology firms in the U.S. Of course, these are international, multinational organizations. The 60 firms together control, you know, something like $2 trillion of the gross national product. These are huge organizations and really vital organizations to many economies. So we tracked these organizations over a six-year period. We assessed their organization culture first in terms of how adaptable it was over time, whether adaptability and innovation were primary content dimensions of the culture, and second, in terms of how strong the culture was, right, from weak to strong, meaning how much did people within the organization agree about a whole array of cultural attributes. I've developed a quantitative way of assessing organizational culture. We tracked these firms for 6 years and related these cultural attributes to their financial bottom line performance. What we found was that indeed the organizations that were both strong and highly adaptable were the ones that showed the highest growth and financial success over the six-year period. Now you would expect by that, by logical reasoning, that the least effective would be weak cultures that were less adaptable. But they weren't. Those firms came in second. So it really didn't matter sort of how weak the culture was if you were low on adaptability. In fact, this led to what we call medium performance. And in fact, what this shows is that having a weak culture is in some ways, and this is a side point, a kind of a weaker way of inviting innovation or a lack of alignment within your organization. So by trial and error, occasionally you're adaptable anyway. The worst case scenario, the firms that performed the worst, were those that had strong cultures that did not emphasize adaptability and innovation. And just as a watch out, this included firms that emphasized results as part of their culture. Okay, so what we're saying is even if you have an organization that focuses on performance and results, if you're not also focused on high adaptability and innovation, that over time, your performance could get stuck. This is a kind of inertia that can stick organizations and prevent them from performing effectively. And just so you have a sense of what this means in financial terms for these organizations, being in that green quadrant up there in the upper right side, for these firms, their annual revenue is about $32 billion. Being in the green quadrant was worth about 15% in gains in annual revenue or about $5 billion a year. So we're talking about real financial value here as a result of getting the culture right.
We have another question, if you don't mind.
Please.
So as organizations have been adapting to COVID and the globe is contemplating a continuing pandemic into the next year and possibly beyond, the question is, are there steps that organizations can take to continue to promote this organizational engagement or culture, even as some level of COVID fatigue sets in?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic question, and we're answering that question in real time. We've got a big project going called the Silver Linings Project that's tracking what organizations are doing to adapt their cultures to the pandemic. If any of you are interested in participating in this study, please feel free to get in touch with me. We are inviting more organizations to participate. My email address is the best way to reach me, but if you're interested in participating in that research, please come and find me. Let me give you a kind of broad example of what I thought I'd come back to Southwest, since I touted Southwest as such a culturally effective organization. And, you know, what you can see for Southwest during the pandemic is that there's a slew of things that Southwest has done to adapt to the pandemic, you know, including how they're handling customers and passengers, how they're treating employees. They're not laying people off. They're doing a voluntary separation. So far, there have been no systematic layoffs, which is in contrast to the other airlines, even though they are suffering significantly, as is the entire airline industry worldwide. So you can see individual organizations adapting. But some of the bigger patterns and trends that we're seeing in our research, first, are that it turns out if your back's against the wall and there's a sense of urgency, organizations are able to change culture, change their cultures faster than they believed that they could. And that's a really important kind of meta competence to keep in mind for the future when an organization has to pivot quickly. It turns out that many organizations actually had a hidden capacity to do that that they didn't think that they had. And the smartest organizations are really leveraging that fact in important ways. What we're finding is that many organizations, at least in the first stages of the pandemic, have increased their level of supportiveness rather than being as performance-driven, although we have found a few organizations that have managed to simultaneously be very, very supportive while they're pushing on performance as well. These are organizations that are highly implicated in the pandemic and didn't have the luxury of reducing their level of productivity. Senior teams are communicating more with entire organizations, which is valuable. It looks like there's now a phased approach to the crisis. And what we're seeing is that employee commitment is eroding slightly. And so organizations that have more, what I call rituals, that have more time for employees to get together, even virtually, to spend time together in ways that they might have back at the office, having lunch together, not having an agenda necessarily, or having, you know, a Friday afternoon get together that's really just social in nature. Those things sound trivial and trite and are certainly harder to do virtually, but they end up being vital to keeping people committed and connected to the organizations that they're a part of. So stay tuned to this. We're learning much more about this, and I'll be happy to share those results as they come around. Okay, so let me get to the sort of the last and most important part of the billing of our time today, which is to focus on narcissistic leaders, which has been a stream of my research over the last 4 years as a U.S. citizen, but even beyond that, this is a really interesting topic. And one of the reasons it's so interesting is that we know that among CEOs, the narcissistic personality is overrepresented, meaning that the proportion of people who score high on narcissism, and there's actually a narcissism scale, are overrepresented among CEOs. And that has led me to start asking a number of questions. So the first piece of this is to understand what we mean when we talk about a narcissist and the narcissistic personality. And clinical psychologists and personality psychologists have been researching this construct for decades. And so we actually know a lot about what are the signature traits of the narcissistic personality. And what we know is that there are a set of attractive traits associated with narcissism, and then there are a set of attributes that tend to emerge over time that are less functional within organizational settings. On the attractor side, narcissists tend to have, well, what we call grandiose narcissists tend to have big, exciting ideas. They are often charismatic. They are often very good at speaking to large groups of people. They are often charming and interpersonally skilled. They are very, very confident. They have a sense of their own self-importance and the importance of their ideas, which can be positively contagious in some ways. They are not shy about promoting their ideas or promoting themselves. They like to seek out leadership roles, which is partly why this CEO situation is the way that it is. They often convey the image of a prototypically effective leader. I would argue that boards of directors have a hard time distinguishing narcissists from visionary leaders, and that's part of the reason that CEOs are high on narcissism. Narcissists have a strong sense of self-efficacy. They're very effective in selling their ideas to others. They feel a sense of entitlement, and they tend to manipulate others in ways that we find appealing. So these are all the attributes of narcissism that draw us in, make us sort of susceptible to the kind of ideas and appeal that they have. On the other hand, over time, narcissists tend to demonstrate a sense of personal superiority. They desire power and dominance. They seek confirmation of their superiority. They lack empathy. They are willing to exploit others. They are much more willing to take credit rather than to share credit with others. They devalue others. They're a little thin-skinned and shift blame to others. and they're aggressive and hostile when confronted with criticism. And this leads to one of my favorite quotes of all time, which is when a famous narcissist said, "I think I'm actually humble. I think I'm much more humble than you would understand," which what I love about that one is not only is it self-aggrandizing, it is also a put down to the other person who said this. Of course, it was the U.S. President Donald Trump, who's a famous narcissist, on July 17th, 2016, again to Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, the first version. So that's a great kind of exemplar of this set of attributes. Okay, so I'm going to show you results from four different studies. I have to tell you that my favorite all-time result, which is more of a fun fact than a result, across all these studies, is that the most stable finding is that narcissists have significantly larger signatures than other people. So that's one quick test. If you want to look to see how big someone signs their name, it's statistically significant. It's kind of across the board. That's our fun fact for the day. But let me tell you a little bit more about kind of the scientific research that we've done on narcissists. So what I call peril number one, narcissistic CEOs tend to get themselves compensated significantly more than their top executive teams over time. What we find is that the red line are narcissists, the blue line are people who are not narcissistic. This is a sample of CEOs in publicly traded firms. This is the gap between the narcissistic CEO's compensation and their top management team's compensation. And what we see is for narcissists over time, that gap grows larger. In other words, their pay is much higher than the top executive team. Whereas for CEOs who are not narcissistic, the gap between them and their top management team declines, meaning that they are sharing credit. So what we can see is that narcissistic leaders overclaim credit for organizational outcomes. This compensation gap occurs even though narcissistic CEOs don't perform better than non-narcissistic CEOs. And so you know that this is real money. One standard deviation difference in narcissism is worth about $5.1 million in compensation. So this is real money here. So that's our first study. The second study, which I think is particularly interesting to this audience, is that narcissistic leaders tend to embroil their organizations in more and more protracted lawsuits. So perhaps an opportunity for more business, but wait, let me tell you the perils first, and then you can decide whether this is who you want as your client. So we see this as a trend. We looked at publicly traded organizations again. We assessed their CEOs in terms of narcissism. We had their employees assess the CEO in terms of narcissism. We found that more narcissistic CEOs engaged in more lawsuits. But we also did an experiment. And what we did was we brought people into the lab and assessed their level of narcissism and then exposed them to a scenario where they had to make a decision about launching a product that was at risk of eliciting a patent infringement lawsuit from their competitors. And in one case, there was a 20% risk of this patent infringement lawsuit being brought. And in another case, there was an 80% risk that this patent infringement case would be brought. And these estimates were provided by the legal counsel, the experts that were providing information to the decision makers in this case. And we looked at narcissistic and less narcissistic folks. And the blue is the low narcissist and the red is the high narcissist. At the 20% risk level, there was no difference, and there was a higher propensity to launch the product anyway because of the lower possibility of the case being brought. However, when the possibility of being sued was 80%, what we see is that low narcissists adjust. They are much less likely to launch the product. High narcissists are just as likely to launch as in the 20% case. And so what we could say here is that narcissists are more insensitive to risk. They are overconfident that their ideas and plans are going to go well. And so assessing a narcissist's risk tolerance ends up being very, very important. In our third study, we expanded that a little bit. And what we found was that narcissistic leaders were much less likely to listen to their expert advisors. They expected loyalty from others, but didn't necessarily reciprocate such loyalty. And narcissists are more susceptible to ingratiation, meaning that their evaluation of you depends on how much you suck up to them. So you can imagine, kind of as legal counsel, this is not a good profile here. They're less likely to listen to you. They want you to be loyal to them, but they're not going to be loyal to you. And in order to get their attention, you have to tell them what they want to hear. It's a bad combination for learning over time. You could say it's the opposite of a learning mindset. And finally, let me tell you the last study here. It just came out. It's in press at a journal. It's actually gotten a lot of coverage kind of around the world because I think the findings are quite important and very concerning. So what we learned from this study is we assessed leader narcissism again of practicing CEOs based on their employees' perceptions of them. And then we assessed the cultures of the organizations that these narcissists had cultivated. And generally what we found was that narcissistic leaders have organizational cultures that are lower in collaboration and lower in integrity. So actually in this paper, if you were to read the academic version of this paper, if you're insomniac, we did 5 different studies, close to 2,000 participants in various studies. We did a bunch of field studies and laboratory experiments, and they all pointed in exactly the same direction. So what we found was that narcissistic CEOs are less likely to endorse policies that create cultures high in integrity and collaboration. They don't care about those. They are more willing to hire, promote, and reward people who demonstrate behaviors associated with low integrity and low collaboration, whether or not those people are narcissists themselves. These are the behaviors that narcissistic leaders are favoring, hiring based on, and promoting based on. So what this means is they're not creating organizations full of narcissists, but they are rewarding behaviors that undermine integrity and collaboration. And face it, collaboration and integrity are kind of the lifeblood of organization life, right? In other words, we don't organize unless we can do something together that none of us could do alone. So collaboration is the essence of organizations. And of course, integrity basically risks an organization's very survival by undermining it. The most disturbing finding from this research is that the culture that was created during the narcissistic leader's tenure actually persists even after the narcissistic leader departs. So the culture outlives the leader. And we know that to be true in general, and it is particularly true in this case. And that's where the risk lies, is that even if you're able to spot the narcissism and stop it in its tracks by replacing someone, that person is going to have to dig out of a fairly deep hole. So let me offer up a couple of suggestions, and then I'm going to stop talking and we'll take your questions. A couple of things that we've seen that look to be helpful. The first is that I'm locating responsibility for grappling with narcissism on decision makers' shoulders. And decision makers include boards of directors. I'm on a board of director, right? We are responsible for hiring and appointing CEOs and monitoring their behavior. I'm also putting this on the shoulder of hiring managers and managers more generally who are involved in both hiring, developing, and promoting people over time. These decision makers need to work hard to select and promote excellent visionary leaders who sometimes visionary leaders and narcissists look exactly the same, right? So the job is really to differentiate between visionary leaders, bona fide visionary leaders, and people who are narcissists masquerading as visionary leaders. One is to recognize that being an ambitious visionary does not require being a narcissist. I get calls from the media all the time where they say, well, you know, to have a big idea, don't you have to be at least a little bit narcissistic? Don't you have to be Elon Musk to think of that idea? And the answer is no, you don't, right? Think about all the counterexamples of people who have had enormous hugely influential ideas who are not narcissists. I like to talk about Bill Gates as a perfect countervailing example. In fact, narcissists may be less likely to recognize the power of the collective effort, given that they discount the importance of experts and what's required to sustain it, given their willingness to increase their compensation while the gap grows bigger with the top management team. A second idea, do your due diligence. Pay particular attention to what former subordinates and colleagues report about a potential leader narcissist. This to me is like the signature or telltale sign of a narcissist, which is that that person will have left many unhappy people in their wake. They may have enough people who are happy in having worked with them. And so what this means is that you need to go beyond the easy or convenient list that they provide to you of network connections to do serious due diligence to uncover all of the people that a potential candidate has worked with to see if there's a pattern of exploitation and a lack of investment in others. That's a very, very important sign that narcissism may be at play. The third, and this is just good practice generally, zero tolerance for exploitative and self-entitled behavior in organizations. And you know the kind of behavior that I'm talking about. And sometimes we let this slide for our high performers, and it is a slippery slope. Zero tolerance, I would say. I think it's important to calibrate a leader's risk profile to understand their sensitivity to risk. And if you see them making outsized risks, that's a problem. I think you want to fact check and closely monitor grandiose big ideas. This is something that you can do. I think you want to regularly use 360-degree feedback and build in developing others and collaborating with peers into performance reviews. And you want to base a significant part of a leader's compensation on developing their people and the team's and organization's performance. So those are just a few ideas for how to deal with narcissistic leaders if you think you're in that situation. Let me stop there and see what questions you have.
Great. Thank you so much. We do have quite a few questions, and I'm going to try to take a few of the questions and put them into one that really focuses on the idea of how, when you have a narcissistic leader in place that is not going anywhere in the foreseeable future, if there are effective ways to communicate, provide feedback, or work through those attributes so that they don't overly negatively impact the current culture of the organization?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And the advice that I've offered has primarily been from the vantage point of the people who are senior to the narcissist, right? Who have a chance to put those controls in place themselves. But you're asking the question from the perspective of someone who may be subject to a narcissistic leader. And that's a really important vantage point as well. And one of the sort of tactics that I recommend is to do your due diligence in trying to understand what's important in terms of outcomes for that narcissistic leader and to frame your contributions in terms of what that person believes to be important. In other words, to try to align your interests in a way that, you know, you're kind of on the same team together. And this is something that I recommend for all subordinates to kind of manage upwards, to manage your boss. Sometimes you have bosses who are micromanagers, who are, you know, breathing down your neck and not trusting the work that you're doing. And what I would suggest is that you be very clear and transparent about the way that you are helping the leader accomplish what she or he is trying to accomplish. So maybe there's a little self-promotion there. Maybe there's a little bit more clarity about, you know, hey, look, we got this outcome that's been really good for you. That's great. I'm so excited for you. Here's how we got there. You can trust me more. And I'm on the team, essentially. So I think that's one way to kind of align your interests. And let me say one other thing, which is If you can develop an organization that also cares about developing others, you'll be in a better position because that leader will be accountable to her or his bosses to ensure that they're developing you as well. So I would put yourself in the position of, you know, it's worth investing in me. You can count on me to do a great job. We're on the same team. Let's align our interests. It's not an easy situation, but there are some pathways.
Thank you. The next question is, again, kind of a combination between two questions from attendees, Dee Dee and Marianne. And what these questions circle around are, what advice can you give on how to provide constructive feedback to narcissistic CEOs, knowing that they may react negatively to that constructive feedback, and to have strategies to get them to implement? You may have addressed some of those in response to the last question, but if there's any effective manners to provide feedback.
Yeah, so I know this is a very tricky thing to do because narcissists tend to be very thin-skinned. They often are very liberal in their willingness to dish out critiques of others and very, very reticent to take that in themselves. So the first thing I would recommend is to consult with your HR experts who actually have knowledge of, you know, how to provide feedback effectively. The second thing is I would never use like single standalone one person's feedback. I would always use aggregated feedback that shows patterns and trends. And just like any good performance review, you would start with the positive parts. You would also ask the person how they think they're doing and where they think their opportunities for improvement are. And if there are some openings, if they're at least self-aware enough to realize that they have, you know, some opportunities, that would be an opening for providing really constructive feedback. But you are going to need to offer the positive stuff first. It's going to need to be patterns and trends. You want to provide examples. It would be like the most effective performance review on steroids. This is the way you need to approach narcissists because of their thin skin.
Thank you. The next question comes from Lorraine. And it is, are there ways to fix the culture after a narcissist has left?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic question. And you can see there are a number of organizations who've gone through these kinds of ups and downs and challenging times. And the fixes really have to do with all of the practices that we recommend for building an effective culture. Which is, and this is going to sound overly simplistic, my last name is Chatman, I think in terms of three C's: consistency, comprehensiveness, and coherence, right? So if in fact integrity is important, which I would argue it is in all organizations, and if in fact collaboration is important, you need to provide evidence to people in the organization that that is true. And the only way to do that is consistency in practices, comprehensiveness in practiveness, and coherence. Why? Because that's when people trust that it's real. The worst challenge in a culture is having a vacuous culture where you say, oh, we're all about integrity. And in fact, you know, every day there's some violation that people can see of that very practice. So it requires a kind of deliberateness and intentionality that allows you to rebuild a belief that, in fact, that's what your culture is about. I do this in my consulting work, and what we do is we start by assessing the current culture and comparing it to what would be the ideal culture if the organization were fully executing on its strategy. We can then quantitatively assess the gaps between the current and the ideal culture. And it allows us to get to work on developing practices to close those gaps. And I would argue that the same technique would be relevant in an organization that has gone astray.
Thank you. The next question is from Dawn, and I'm going to add a little bit to the end of it as well. And the question is, are there varying degrees of narcissism that can be good for an organization? And then I would add, and if so, are there strategies that you can use to kind of invigorate those good attributes of a narcissistic leader and then mitigate the risk proposition?
Yeah. The answer is no. There's no So the point I'm trying to make is that there are attributes that are appealing that narcissists engage in. And you don't have to be a narcissist to have a great idea. You don't have to be a narcissist to be a visionary leader. My preference is low on the narcissists, high on the great idea generation and the passion and the charisma and, you know, the ways of exciting people and getting them going. Those behaviors are not the exclusive domain of narcissists. Those are behaviors that we all have access to. And because of the risk, I think you want to leave the narcissistic piece aside. This is similar to the question I get in the media. Don't you have to be a little bit narcissistic to have good ideas? The answer is no.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you all of our attendees for the excellent questions. We are at our time to wrap up now. We appreciate all of the wonderful insights that you've provided, Dr. Chapman. Thank you so much for joining us today. I will now turn this back over to Pete Waltz to close out the program.
Thanks, Naomi, and to Dr. Chapman for sharing her valuable knowledge on the narcissistic executive. For our listeners who would like to connect with Dr. Chapman, please visit the information on our website at ela.law. If you'd like to find any of the lawyers that we have in the Employment Law Alliance around the world, just visit the website, go to the big Find a Lawyer widget in the center of the page, click on the drop-down box. There you can receive information to upcoming webinars, download white papers, or access our exclusive Global Employers Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Pete Waltz. Thanks for listening.